I recognize the email address. This guy has written to me periodically over the years, either to share outrage over some social injustice, add a little insight, or offer warm concern. But for the first time, he's the one in trouble, about to be evicted and start sleeping in his van. He's worried that with his congestive heart failure, COPD, and peripheral artery disease, the cold will kill him. He's also worried that he'll be arrested. After the Supreme Court ruling in Grants Pass, which just gave local governments the right to enforce camping regulations when people are unhoused, the cops now have a free hand to screw over homeless people with zero accountability, he points out. Worried for him, I zap back suggestions. Find someone to share a small, cheap apartment with? Ask the hospital social worker for resources when he goes next time? Find someone who would like a caretaker to live in their carriage house or shed? That, it turns out, is where John has been living for the past several years, an unlit, unplumbed tool shed on the property of a Christian farmer who has now lost patience with him. John blames his own refusal to be evangelized. But later, he describes the guy's anger when John needed an ambulance. He refused to get on the gurney. The idea of being strapped onto that stretcher panicked him. It felt unsafe. The farmer tried to force him to comply, which I can imagine as a frustration born of care. But to John, the insistence felt infantilizing, with no concern for his wishes, dignity, preference. None of this is simple. By the next email, he's sleeping in his van and emailing from a Barnes & Noble. Exhausted by the move, he's freezing. He has to sleep in the nude because a bladder stone is causing nighttime incontinence. And he lies on a plastic sheet that, in the cold, is a little like trying to force yourself to lie down on ice. On top of which, the urine-soaked blankets are chilly and smelly, and he has no way to wash and dry them. He struggles to breathe after the exertion, and the van is crammed with all his possessions, so when he was trying to figure out a way to stretch out his legs, a box fell on him and gashed his shoulder. If I'd been given a choice of being born into this world, he writes, knowing what I now know, I would have definitely opted to pass. The tiny amount of glory and joy over the course of a lifetime is by far outweighed by the sheer physical and emotional hell and overwhelming loneliness. If he can't figure out a way to live more comfortably, he says, he's going to look into doctor-assisted suicide in another state. He has not yet given up, though. He wants to know how to post a message Facebook-wide without violating the rules. Surely, he says, there is someone who's willing to let me use their empty garage. I tell him I'm not sure there is a way to send a message that widely on Facebook. I send contact info for a bunch of agencies in Wichita. They all seem, to me, so hopeful, with names like Rapid Rehousing and Homeless Outreach Team and Humankind Ministries and Housing First, which even helps with utilities. But to qualify for Housing First, he needs a disabling condition and continuous homelessness for at least 1 year, or at least 4 episodes in the past 3 years. I would think that living in a shed would count, and he hasn't worked since a car crash in 2009. He was run over by a guy with no insurance, he says, and his left hip was yanked out of its socket, his right ankle broken in 3 places, his right shoulder joint torn. The same year, he took so much penicillin for bronchitis that he lost most of his hearing in the human voice frequencies. He fought to recover, but eventually wound up retiring at the age of 62. So he receives less in Social Security than he would have if he'd been able to wait. My hearing loss was pretty much the last nail in the coffin of my career potential, he says, explaining his previous jobs as a manufacturing rep and district manager. All jobs require you to interact either with the public or at a minimum with fellow employees. He could apply for Section 8 now, but so many buts. There are long waiting lists for housing, and he's afraid that every time a family applies, someone like him gets kicked to the bottom of the list. You need to understand how the safety net system works, he tells me. When a regular person first inquires, The first blush impression is that there are all these programs out there to help people, until you get into the details. It gets messy quick. Every housing program is set up for certain groups, he continues. Minorities, families, pregnant teens, women escaping domestic violence, etc. Someone like him is, quote, supposed to miraculously be wealthy enough not to need help. If you're white, male, college grad, single, not a felon, no drug addictions, no mental illness, not an alcoholic, you're flat out of luck. John is scared of people attacking him or stealing from him, both of which have happened often, and that makes him distrust shelters as well as Section 8 housing. Also, he'd have to contribute 30% of his income to rent, so even if utilities are covered, that only leaves him with $530 a month to pay for healthy food, over-the-counter or uncovered medicines, gas and repairs for his 10 miles an hour van, occasional replacement of worn shoes or clothing, laundry, paper towels, soap. I live pretty simply and need three times that much. Panicky for him, I throw out ideas scattershot. Move to a small town where the rents are cheaper. Hell, move to Mexico. He says he can't afford driving to a big city for health care. And what if he has a stroke? After 4 minutes with no oxygen, your brain starts suffering permanent damage to your ability to walk, talk, or even feed yourself, he reminds me. As for Mexico, it's unsafe and largely controlled by violent drug cartels, massive police corruption, and I don't know the language. Fair enough. Meanwhile, 653,104 unhoused Americans were counted in last year's single-night census, a record high. The brutal reality, John says, is that you can try with all your might and not leave a single stone unturned and still not make it. His IQ is 130, he says, same as Bill Clinton's, and he graduated from college with a 4.0 in his major, but he often had trouble finding work. When he was younger, he dug ditches and worked in orange groves and on loading docks. Then he landed corporate jobs, but never the sort that come with 401ks or pensions. Probably 50% of average folks are on one paycheck, job loss, or medical emergency away from being homeless themselves, he says, and many would be homeless except that they split rent or are married, but they choose to look down their nose at you. He's done with charity. Every time I deal with Christians, they'll help me for a little while, thinking that they're going to get me to convert back to Christianity, and when I don't, they decide to stop helping me and start blaming me for not being grateful enough for their help. He offers furious examples of excess and hypocrisy, and his anger makes even more sense when I learn that he was ordained a Methodist minister in his 20s. By age 35, he felt duped and became an atheist. Now he's hoping to reach other atheists who might lend a hand, or more precisely, a living space. Could I help him set up a GoFundMe plea? He's convinced that if he just reaches out widely enough, the net will catch some kindness. I can't do this for myself, he explains. In American society, no one is allowed to toot their own horn or ask for their own needs. It takes a third party to vouch for the need to get people to give. I doubt people will hand over cash or living space to a man they do not know. That is why he needs me to vouch for him, he says. But they do not know me either, I point out, and I do not know you in any meaningful way. We've never even met. Do you not believe I am who I say I am? He asks. Sadly, I do believe him. I'd rather think this is a scam, concocted by someone healthy and well-fed who goes home to an unsuspecting family. But I've encountered so many people like John. Introverted, stubborn, sharply intelligent, but for one reason or another, incapable of either supporting themselves or winning others' support. Nonetheless, I ask for his full name, John Williamson, and check Wichita's court records. He has committed no known crimes, save the crime of not succeeding in the way we think imperative. After being raised by a widowed mother who worked nonstop, then working nonstop myself for 4 decades, I harbor a mean-spirited demon who hisses that no one has the right to just hold out a hand to strangers and expect to be saved. The demon also whispers that I am more self-reliant than lucky, more hard-working than privileged and healthy. The demon lies, but I love to listen to him. John, meanwhile, is set on GoFundMe. I think it's a numbers game of finding the right person, he writes, attaching a news article about two little girls and a migrant family using Wi-Fi at a Taco Bell to do their homework, and a GoFundMe bringing in $115,000 for them. What I do not say in response? Some forms of misery are more palatable than others. He already knows this through painful experience. But the magic of crowdsourced compassion is the only plan that feels hopeful right now. I toss out more ideas. A cemetery that needs a caretaker? A company that needs a watchman on site? A cheap mobile home? I don't mean to put a damper on your suggestions. I know you're trying, he writes, but I checked into house sitting with real estate companies long ago. Caretaker positions are more myth than reality. Storage facilities won't lease to you if they even think you might be trying to live in it. Idiot zoning laws make it illegal. As late as the 1930s, he tells me, there were no homeless shelters. Friends and family took people into their own homes. Even that would not work for John, though. His only remaining relative is a brother he lost touch with years ago. What about looking up old friends? Unfortunately, sadly, I never really had any friends to lose, he replies. Even as a young child, the few neighborhood kids were about the only friends I've ever had, and even then, they were very light friendships. I was shunned because, unlike all the other kids who had dads, I didn't have anyone to pay back by taking everyone out to entertainment or to the lake house. So I ended up always alone. It was very brutal. You'd think maybe the adult parents would have had pity on me, being the son of a single mom, a divorcee, but instead they were outright mean. All the neighborhood dads were redneck male macho types, so being kind wasn't one of their attributes. I mainly only had one key friend in high school, a guy in my rock band, who honestly wasn't much of a friend. I worked afternoons after school at grocery stores until 9 or 10 p.m. and went to school during the day, so really little room for relationships, especially since so much of that age revolves around sports and school teams I wanted nothing to do with. I hate sports. Also, make no mistake about it, I was heavily unpopular and made fun of because I didn't drink, smoke, or do drugs. I was an outcast nerd. Not ever finding a wife or girlfriend has been my life's greatest sorrow by far over-encompassing every other loss in my life. Muted by that stark loneliness, I turned to bureaucracy. With all those health problems, he could still apply for disability. SSI takes forever to qualify for, he replies, and comes with a lot of restrictions, including how much cash you can even have on hand. Maximum liquid asset limit of only $2,000, cash included. If I were John, I would try. But this entire exercise has been me popping up with things that I, free of limits, healthy, with savings, and fresh from musing about the emotional importance of having a home, would do. In rapid succession, I've had every reaction I deplore in others. He should find a job. Be more tractable so people will like him and help him. Put up with the evangelization, maybe even feign interest. Would it kill him? Budget that $750 better. All he wants is a garage, empty office, warehouse corner or shed where he could live. I can buy a large card table, folding chair, air mattress, and plastic bookshelving, he writes. I already have a desk lamp and even wall posters to make a garage feel more home-like. His dream is to have heating, cooling, a toilet, shower, and space to work in. His question is, why is it okay for society to price people out of housing to fund rich property owners? And then society blames the poor for not being able to afford rent. Why do people not see shelter as a basic human right? Is there literally not a single man, woman, family, or social organization in my entire country willing to help me live with minimum basic dignity?